Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Well, the UK is going to be in lockdown for a while yet, it seems, so lots of businesses are going to struggle to survive. And yet we're told things will bounce back in the second half of the year. It'll be like the roaring 20s all over again. So should we be optimistic? Or more likely, is it going to be the case that the economy is so severely scarred and people are out of work that bouncing back is going to take some time, perhaps a lot of time, not just in the UK, but throughout the world? And overly optimistic governments might be part of the problem. That's today on the Debunking Economics podcast with Professor Steve Keen. I'm Phil Dobby. Welcome along. So consumers in the UK paid off £16.6 billion in debt last year. Now, that will have contributed to part of the slowdown in economic growth. The other contributing factor, of course, will be the fact that no one's been able to go to work, or lots of people haven't been able to go to work. So productivity is stuffed. But also, if we're paying off debt, then we are pulling money out of the economy as well. Apart from a blip in July, consumer credit has turned negative ever since the pandemic began. We are just not borrowing, it seems. And there is a clear divide emerging in the UK, and I'm sure it's the same in other parts of the world too. Those people without a job are getting heavily into debt. Those with a job and very few ways of spending their income are saving. In fact, the household savings ratio as a proportion of disposable income went from 7.7% in Q4 2019 to 27.4% in Q2 2020. The Bank of England governor has called it a coiled spring that is ready to bounce back. Others have suggested we are about to relive the roaring 20s, because that was a period when we spent up latent savings. So is that where we are today? Is that how you see it happening, Steve? Because a lot of people are saying, yes, this is going to be the start of something big. We are going to spend like crazy. Can you see that happening?
No, I can't. And this is actually intriguing, because it comes down to how is savings defined? How's it measured in the national accounts to get figures like that? And the way that it's measured is simply saying, well, here's the consumption levels. The gap must be savings. But oh, let's not count the money used to service private debt in the consumption. So they're not directly recording what's happening to bank accounts in that. They're simply saying if people earn, they a $1 trillion and spend $700 billion, ipso facto, and they must have saved $300 billion. But when you go take a look at the actual numbers for banks, you can find that rather than the level of, therefore, of debt falling, the level of debt is actually rising. And so how do you reconcile the two? It's because it's just using a strict national income identity, you know, income equals consumption plus investment plus government spending minus taxes plus exports minus imports. And then if you do the sum of everything, they're looking on the consumption side for consumers, and you see income is either consumed or saved, then whatever is consumed, the gap is the savings. Bang, this huge level of savings. But the servicing of private debt is not included as part of the expenditure, which would be great if they actually told us we didn't have to spend any more on that. That'd make us all a lot wealthier. But it means you get into a huge disparity between the figures you can derive from playing around with the national accounts and the figures you get when you look at bank statements.
But anecdotally, you know, I know lots of people who are working because they work, they can work from home, they can work online, who are saying they are saving money. I mean, in fact, almost, you know, everybody I know who's in that situation is saying, yeah, we're spending less because we're not getting on the train into London, for example. We've not been able to go on foreign holidays. So those people who've got a reasonable amount of money have been saving money. So is that pent-up demand still going to come back?
The part of your comment you made earlier about who's doing it is a large part of it, because you can only have that pent-up demand if you've still got an income.
Yeah.
And, of course, this is what happened during the Great Depression. And my own family, and my mother's side, was a beneficiary of this, because my grandfather was a post office manager. And consequently, he didn't lose his job during the Great Depression, and because there was a fall in the price level, this applied, you know, globally, there was deflation. His real income actually rose over that period. So my even though you were, you know, you were affected by it by seeing what happened on the street every day, and that's a bit like what we're seeing with, you know, the COVID-19 now as well. Only the people who lost their jobs are really devastated. Of course, that's a large part of the population during a depression. But the people with a job did very, very well, thanks very much, out of that downturn, unless they were silly enough to have owned shares beforehand, of course, which sort of evened things out.
Well, the Bank of England, their own figures, they say the savings are in higher income households. Those who have increased their savings, the mean income, this is from a survey they did for their monetary committee, so they could try and figure out what's going on in households. So they commissioned this regular survey. Those who say that they have increased their savings, so this is just people's own perception that they've gotten more money. The mean income of those people was close to £50,000. That's a household income. Those who said they saw their savings decrease, the mean income was around £30,000. So it is there. Those people who are saving are higher income households. Absolutely no surprise there. But I wonder whether they will still spend it, or whether they're in higher income households, they're going to say, "Well, we'll put it away. We'll spend it on our pension, or we won't use it just now because we're a little bit unsure about the future just yet."
Yeah, I think what you're going to find is that, again, the distributional effect comes into play. And the people who've saving out of this are ones who are likely to have low levels of debt to begin with, maybe, and they're possibly going to be using money to buy assets, maybe even shares in what's that American one that's going through the roof right now, GameStop?
GameStop.
And benefit
it's
out of that.
It's been up and down. I don't think it's through the roof anymore. But no.
They
could buy Bitcoin, for example, couldn't they? If you want to talk about an asset that's really going crazy, they could put it into Bitcoin if they really want to lose it at some point in the future.
But like, if I look at the aggregate data for let's start with the UK here, and look at what happens to level of household debt. If it was true there's massive amounts of savings, then there could be a massive reduction in the level of household debt. If you go back to 2020, the beginning of the year, the level of household debt in the UK was 84% of GDP. It is now 89% of GDP. That's a five and, you know, over more than, and sorry, that's not now, my mistake, that's June of last year.
Yeah, so only halfway through. And it's got much worse
since
then.
Yeah. In 6 months, there's been a 5% increase, 5% of GDP increase in the level of household debt, which is, because it's only 80% to start with, far more than a 5% rise. Yeah, actually, just going right back, it's from 84 to 89%. So the way numbers are going, by the time you get to data at the end of 2021, beginning of 2021, end of 2020, you're going to see possibly a 10% of GDP increase in household debt in the UK.
And a chunk of that is probably going to be small, you know, very small businesses, people who've been forced to borrow to keep their business afloat. They've not been getting necessary aid from the government. So, you know, for sole traders, it's very difficult to divide distinguish household debt from your business's debts, because they all just mesh together, aren't they, in effect?
Well, yeah, I mean, this tends to be, I think the way data is assembled, it tends to be looking at mortgages and unsecured household debt. So if you're a small business person, you'll often dip into if you have any buffer in your mortgage, you'll dip into the buffer when you need to. So that could explain, you know, the increases in debt there. But again, the income distribution you're talking about, that goes against the small business argument.
Yeah, yeah. Mm. And we know small businesses are also getting into debt with banks. So net bank borrowing by small and medium business in 2020 was $43.3 billion compared to 2019, $1.4 billion. It's a massive increase in small business debt.
And you're seeing the same thing in the corporate figure. So again, in the UK, corporate debt started at 70% of GDP in the beginning of 2020. By June, it's 79%. So that's a 10% of GDP increase in corporate debt. So that just doesn't gel at all with the arguments about massive amounts of savings going on. And it's because the economists who are saying this are working for the national income identities. If C falls, and Y remains relatively stable, then this is again because of a lot of, you know, government spending turns up as part of the GDP, net government spending. That's increased dramatically. So those figures can come out looking really, really good. But you look at the bank statements and there's been a massive increase of the indebtedness of the private sector. And that applies in the USA as well. So like the UK situation, 5% of GDP increase in household debt, 10% increase in corporate. In America, the household, and this is only between January and June, I emphasize, household debt began at 74.5% of GDP. It's now 77%, well, June 77%, so about a 3% increase there. And corporate debt has gone up much more dramatically again. Corporate debt began at 75.5% of GDP. It's now 84.5%, so a 9% of GDP increase in corporate debt. So the aggregate figure of private debt in the UK, and I'm trying to bombarding listeners with numbers here, has gone from 150% to 162% in 6 months in America. And in the UK, it's gone, again, I've got to just go move through a couple of graphs here. It's gone from 154% in January to 168% in June. So I think economists are leading themselves astray by their own accounting methods, which is extremely amazing for me. I've never seen them do it before.
Sarcasm is shining through as usual, Steve. We've got
there you go.
The governor of the Reserve Bank, you know, the Bank of England, Andrew Bailey, is saying, you know, no, it's all going to come back like a coiled spring, and he's pointing specifically to this household saving figure. And I'm sure this is why the UK, because they're looking at all of these savings, is saying, well, we don't need to do anything like they've done in the United States, where, you know, we pay money into people's bank accounts. Could we find that, you know, the idea of an economy stalls because of that? And in fact, the best thing to do might be just as Kevin Rudd did in 2007 or 2008, whenever it was in Australia, pumping money into people's bank accounts might actually be the best way to kickstart the economy.
I think so. I mean, this will be classic if it actually happens, because this is a classic instance of economists not understanding banks' debt and money, telling us what to do about banks' debt and money. And but just by doing the simple, you know, Y equals, you know, savings is equal to Y minus income minus consumption, basically, seeing a fall in consumption, relatively comparatively stable figures in an output, and bang, you assume people have saved the money. No, the way you record the numbers is you're not including debt service and you're not including the change in debt at all. You're not measuring that at all.
No.
So you're extending what you're seeing as savings from a national accounting sense. You're extrapolating to believe people are going to have more money in their bank accounts and less debt. The reality is there may be some with more money in their bank accounts, but the aggregate level of debt's gone up dramatically.
Well, can't we check that just by looking at the amount of money in people's bank accounts?
Exactly what I'm doing, mate.
Right, okay.
But they don't do it. See, but your banks don't matter in neoclassical economics. So, I mean, this is what I find, you know, one of the things, that many things that I'm crazy about economics in general, is that economic institutions, I won't say economists collect this stuff, but just because, particularly because a guy called Copeland was involved in designing the National Income and Production Accounts of America, they're called the NIPA tables. And he designed those as a form of economic management after the Second World War. And this is all, you know, if you think about the Second World War, it was a huge planning exercise. It was directed manufacturing, planning consumption, trying to restrict personal consumption, force people to save, and actually getting into their bank accounts as well. This all happened during the Second World War. And then in the aftermath, all the mechanics that should work so well, you know, if it worked so well, that's why you and I still speak English. If it hadn't worked that well, things would be very different. But Copeland included very comprehensive data on the what they call the flow of funds as part of the NIPA tables, and that includes the amount of debt, private debt, different classifications of the debt. It's a dog's breakfast at the very bottom level of the table, unfortunately, because he didn't distinguish properly between bank debt and non-bank debt. So That's one of the things I find frustrating about it. But the data's there. Now, at the same time, economists who now run those institutions have convinced themselves that banks and debt and money don't matter, so they don't even look at these bloody numbers in the first place.
Yeah. So what you're saying is the way they're looking at and assuming the build-up of savings doesn't tally with just looking at bank accounts. So they're saying savings are increasing. You say you look at bank accounts, you see that bank accounts are actually decreasing. The amount.
I'm looking specifically at levels of debt here, which is increasing dramatically and radically. It's the trouble.
But it could
again,
be the could be there'll be a distribution fact here as well, though, won't there?
Definitely.
We know that a lot of people are. I mean, it's getting back to that K-shaped curve that everyone talks about. You're either on the upward curve, in which case you possibly are, you probably are saving, or you're on the other side where your debt is going down. It's a question about how one balances against the other. But the bigger question is, how do we stop that happening? And how do we take some money from those savings to help grow the other half of the economy? You know, and the great hope, I think, coming from everybody is that, well, when things kick back to normal, those with savings are going to be out spending, and they are going to help to reduce the debts of the other half of society, because they'll be shopping in their shops or buying whatever it is they produce, and they'll be getting people off the dole and back into work, and everything's going to be hunky-dory. It's all going to, one half is going to help the other half. That's the assumption.
Yeah, I mean, the wealthy half hearing the helping out the poorer half would be a novel experience.
Trickle down, Steve, trickle down.
I've realized that we pronounce it wrongly. It's actually quite true, but it's pronounced wrongly. It's actually trickle down.
All right.
Okay.
Clutching at the straws, perhaps a little bit. Okay. But look, the unemployment number is a worry, isn't it? So we had 1.7 million people unemployed in October. Okay, it doesn't sound like a huge number, but it's a 32% increase in a year. And top that up with that big increase in small business borrowing as well. That small business part of the economy, mixed with people who are just not working. I mean, there's going to be more stimulus needed than the government is prepared to give right now.
And that's what I'm afraid of, is if they think it's over. And like, I've learned since having spent, about 5 years of my life in the UK, that the UK has an incredible capacity to suck defeat from the jaws of victory. So
and economics, yeah.
Exactly. Ever since the Second World War, I think they're probably still guilty about winning it. Don't mention the war. what they're doing here is that they had a total stuff up on the virus. I mean, it's got to be one of the worst. It is the worst country on the planet in terms of death rates, but they're now doing brilliantly out of vaccination. And that largely, I think, reflects the distributed nature of the national NHS. I knew this when living in the UK. I was quite lucky to be living two doors from the local NHS clinic, if you wanted to get anything checked up, you'd make a call in the morning. You'd wait for a call back in the mid morning to tell you which doctor you were seeing in the afternoon. Go in and get whatever's necessary and leave. I had a tetanus shot there that way one time. This will be, the success with the vaccine is huge. If that lulls them to believing, it's all over now, and now we've got the vaccine working, we can shut down all the income supports we've got, then when they do it, the people who are unemployed are going to be unable to pay their mortgages, their rent, and they're already suffering on that front. I think we could see a slump without a boom beforehand coming out of this.
Well, the opposition, Keir Starmer.
You see, opposition.
Different
party.
Yeah.
The other party.
The
other party. They are the major party in the parliament.
Keir Starmer is the opposition. He's,
opposition.
That
means you've got to oppose, doesn't it?
Yeah. Oh, you think he's not doing that? Well, no, that's what I was going to say. Well, exactly the point I was trying to make. In fact, he's basically towing the same line.
But exactly. Same thing in Australia. Yeah.
He came out with this crazy idea. Now, you talked a while ago on this podcast about the need for coronavirus bonds.
Yep.
But that has somewhat been overtaken by events, because your argument there was basically we should just issue a lot of bonds, which the Bank of England could buy, and that would fund the government through this. But we do, whether we call them coronavirus bonds or not, that's exactly what's happened, isn't it? The government issued a whole heap of bonds because they've got heavily into, well, let's use the word debt, just so everyone understands it, and the central bank has bought them. So Keir Starmer is now saying, well, we need recovery bonds, but I'm not sure the point of this. He says these would be interest-bearing, safe and long-term, with the proceeds earmarked for post-COVID recovery. But he's seeing it as a retail investment. So mums and dads could buy recovery bonds to do their bit to help Britain recover. But why would you do that? Because that would add nothing beyond what is currently happening with the government overspending and the Bank of England buying up the bonds. I mean, it's...
Well, in fact, it takes money out of it. This is the important qualification about government money creation, and this is why... I'm not sure this is covered in Stephanie Kelton's book. It probably is, but I know I've covered it myself now in that little palindrome paper I put out a while ago called OMOMO, One Monetary Model of Modern Monetary Operations, that when the banks or the government, for that matter, sell bonds to the non-bank public, it's actually reducing the money supply.
Mm.
It's taking money... Because what is happening to pay those bonds, people have to use their deposit accounts. So they transfer money out of their deposit accounts to the government or to the private banks. When they do that, that turns up as an increase in if you're buying the bonds off the government, your deposit account falls, so the bank liabilities go down, and bank liabilities are the major part of the money supply. And then the reserves go down as well, because that money is being transferred to the treasury. So you're actually taking money out of the economy. You're not financing anything. The only way these things would actually finance expenditure by a government agency was if the revenue from the bonds went to local councils instead.
Yeah.
Because if it goes to local councils, and local councils, of course, also operate with bank accounts at private banks. And so the money taken out of the public, if households are buying the bonds, then the household accounts fall by X dollars or X pounds. The local government accounts would rise by X pounds. And then you would actually be just transferring where the money was. You wouldn't change the amount of money in existence. It's not a source of new money, whatever way you look at it. So it's just a fallacy. It's another fallacy coming out of not understanding monetary dynamics.
And even if you weren't following that monetary dynamics argument and you're just looking at, what people were going to do with their money, what is it better to do? Is it better for you to give that money to the government in the form, basically buying up bonds, which means the money is going into government coffers? Or are you better off spending it out in the economy, creating jobs?
In the aftermath of a crisis like this, again, leaving aside the whole climate change issue, which I hate having to leave out in these conversations, but hey.
But let's do it today, just for once.
You're stuck with it. is that you want to boost in aggregate demand, and by selling bonds to the private sector, you're reducing aggregate demand.
Hmm. Yeah. So this idea that you actually boost the money supply by seeing it landing in the bank accounts of local authorities isn't a bad one, actually, is it? Because local authorities can't raise money. But if this money was underwritten by the central banks, I mean, actually, it would be, I would be very wary of buying bonds that have been issued, for example, by Waverley Council, my local council, but I'd be happy for them to have the money to be able to implement local programs, but I'd be very worried about getting my money back off them if I bought those bonds. But if it was underwritten by the central bank, then you'd have that assurance, wouldn't you? Underwritten by the Treasury, whoever underwrites, you'd have that assurance that you're going to get your money back. You'd be quite happy about that. And I think this recovery has to come from the local level up, doesn't it? I think the danger is that you do everything in a too centralised fashion, and you're perhaps going to have huge swathes of the country that really are not going to benefit, however much the Prime Minister talks about levelling things up.
So again, I'm sure somebody in Starmer's advisor goes, oh, this is a great idea. We can sell this as a way that, a patriotic thing. You're helping government out to give the government money that it doesn't actually have. I think they create the money.
He's looking at war. I think what's happened is they've researched what happened in other crises, and they've said, oh, look, war bonds But of course, you know, it was that they were, you know, pre-fiat currency. And stand in the United States. In fact, most of the retail bonds, what were they called? The war bonds there.
Liberty bonds, I think.
Yeah, I think most of them were actually bought out by banks anyway. So they weren't really a retail investment. But it was pre-fiat money days. It was a different issue.
Well, no, it's still the same sort of story because that, I mean, in that case, the government deficit created the money that financed the war. And the Liberty bonds, I don't have the research at my fingers, but when you look at how people who understood what they were talking about, and what's his name, Rummel?
Yeah.
Okay. He saw that as a way of reducing private consumption and reserving more of the money for state expenditure on the war machine. Mm. So rather than the war bonds actually providing money for the war effort, war bonds are a way of taking money out of circulation in the private sector to enable less pressure on factories for consumer goods and enable more of the space for producing military equipment. So the idea that it actually raises money is wrong. And, you know, it looks like it's happening because you're handing over money. It must be, you know, it must be creating it. But you're handing over money, you're taking it out of circulation. It's if you were giving the money to another business or you're giving the money to a local council, then the money doesn't disappear. But if you're paying it to the federal government or you're buying it off a bank, then that's actually reducing the money supply.
Well, that's very encouraging then, isn't it? So on the one side, we've got a government and a central bank that assumes that there's a whole heap of money there that's going to be spent, which in fact doesn't exist and isn't going to be spent. And on the other side, we've got an opposition that says, well, let's make things worse by taking more money out of the economy. We're between a rock, not even between a rock and a hard place, we're between a rock and
the marshmallow.
What's something I don't know. You know, you hate it when you start an analogy and you don't know how you're going to finish it. But between a rock and something far worse. How do we get out of this situation? What is the best answer then? Is it simply just to look at the United States and say, well, okay, we need a big cash injection into people's bank accounts, isn't it?
Yeah, and also a debt jubilee. And this is the one thing, the very first thing I pushed when it was obvious this was going to be a major crisis was let's use it as a way of giving people money, which they're not getting from the cash flow of their ordinary businesses now, and enabling them to pay their debts down. Because if you don't do it, their debts are going to rise because they're going to have financial commitments they can't meet out of cash flow. Therefore, the interest they don't pay is going to be capitalized and accumulated in the level of private debt. And that's probably a large part of what's going on behind those aggregate figures I'm looking at as well.
Right. But the danger of doing that, one thing we did see last year was a big increase in mortgage approvals in 2020. So people are buying houses. Now, whether that's refinancing or, but I think, some of it is it's new investments. So, what's to stop that happening? You know, it's happening already. If you have a debt jubilee and you're writing off debt, people are just going to move to try and spend more in bigger houses. If we all want to spend more on bigger houses, then obviously what happens is ordinary houses just become more expensive. We don't get bigger houses. We just get the same house we had before, but we're paying more for it.
Well, I'd always combine those things with reforms about how much money banks can lend for buying financial assets or buying property. So I wouldn't just do it in a one-off. The trouble is it won't happen. We're talking hypotheticals here.
I'm
old enough to know my ideas won't be listened to except by critics and who are people as critical of the system as I am. So we're putting forward hypotheticals that won't actually happen. But that's what we should be doing, paying down the level of private debt. Now, at the moment, it's exploding. And that's why I think we're going to see, you know, this will be an interesting test case to see just how, whether we have an unexpected downturn coming out of the post-coronavirus period, if we actually get there. And that's the other question, of course. We're still in the middle of a pandemic, and there's no reason the virus is going to cooperate with us and basically, you know, right off into the sunset, we may find ourselves coping with more virulent and more dangerous versions of it as time goes on, particularly thanks to the breeding grounds of the UK and the USA.
Now, I should suggest to everybody, by the way, before you start listening to this podcast, always make sure you're in quite a good mood to start with, because by the end of it, Steve might just be, you might just tip you over the edge. So please be in a good mood so that he can knock you down a couple of rungs, but you're still reasonably sane by the end of it. Let's assume that we get out of all of it and it's going to be, we get over the virus. It is going to be interesting to see, isn't it? The test case, really, another test case for us as to whether we do bounce back, or as you're saying, the economy stalls. And if that is the case, then they will need to raise yet more money to pump money into people's bank accounts, because there'll be very little else they can do, I suspect.
That's right.
As a short-term measure. Let's watch with interest. Good to talk, Steve. See you soon.
Okay, mate. Bye.
And next time, we're going to look at the vaccine rollout. We know that we need it to be everywhere, not just in Western democracies. It's got to get to every corner of the world so that this thing doesn't fester in developing nations and build in new strains which are going to come back to haunt us. So how is the World Health Organization's attempt to roll it out everywhere going? Well, it's a bit short of cash, apparently. So isn't now the time that we should all be stepping in? We'll look at what's happening with the vaccine rollout next time on the Debunking Economics Podcast with Professor Steve Keen. I'm Phil Dobby. I'll see you then. Thanks for listening.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
If you've enjoyed listening to Debunking Economics, even if you haven't, you might also enjoy The Y Curve. Each week, Roger Hearing and I talk to a guest about a topic that is very much in the news that week. It's lively, it's fun, it's informative. What more could you want? So search The Y Curve in your favorite podcast app or go to ycurve.com to listen.